across from her.
"You got the message, then?" she said in her phony English public school accent.
"I got it," Fortunato said, "but the trail's cold. The astronomer could be anywhere by now. I was hoping you might have something else for me."
"Perhaps. You know a yo-yo calls himself Demise?"
"Yes," Fortunato said. His fingernails dug uselessly at the urethane finish on the table.
"He was in about an hour ago. Sasha got a reading off him, loud and clear. He's going to fucking kill me, that twisted old fuck."
"Meaning the astronomer?"
"Right you are. This Demise seemed completely round the bend. Had quite a lot on his mind, Sasha said."
"You mean there's more?" Fortunato said.
"Yes, but the next bit's going to cost you."
"Cash or favors?"
"Blunt this morning, aren't we? Well, I'm inclined to say favors, and in honor of the holiday, I'll even extend you a line of credit."
"You know I'm good for it," Fortunato said, "sooner or later."
"I don't like charging for bad news, in any event. The other line Sasha heard was, maybe he'll be too busy with the others."
"Christ," Fortunato said. Brennan looked at him. "You think he's going on some kind of killing spree?" "The only thing that surprises me is that it took him this long. He must have been waiting for Wildcard Day out of some fucked-up sense of drama or something. Was there anything else?"
"Not about the astronomer, but there is another matter. This is perhaps more in your bailiwick, yeoman. I got a call this morning advising me to keep my eyes open for a certain stolen book. 3 books, actually. 2 of them are stock books with rare postal stamps in them. It was the 3rd the caller seemed most interested in. It's the size of a regular schoolboy's notebook, blue in color, with a bamboo pattern on it."
"So, who's the caller?" Brennan asked.
"Unimportant. What interests me is the group he seems to belong to. It took me a bit of time and a bit of influence, but I came up with a name."
"What's your price?" Brennan said.
"Information for information. I think if we should put our heads together on this, we'd both benefit. But you mustn't hold out on me. I'll know it if you do."
"Agreed."
"Does the name Shadow Fist Society mean anything to you?"
Brennan shook his head. "Not much. I've heard the name in Chinatown, that's all."
"All right," Chrysalis said. "Suppose I mentioned a name high in the organization. He's known as Loophole. Mean anything to either of you?"
Fortunato shook his head. Brennan was looking at the table. "Yeah," Brennan said. "I've heard of him. His real name's something or other Latham, as in Latham Strauss, the law firm. The story is that nobody knows if the wildcard virus destroyed all his human feelings, or if he's just a very, very good lawyer."
Chrysalis nodded. "A fair trade. Shall we go another round?"
"You first," Brennan said.
"By sheerest coincidence, I got another call this morning from a man named Gruber. He's a broker. Pawn, rather than stock, I'm afraid. He was concerned about some stock books full of stamps an ace tried to sell him this morning, called, apparently, Wraith. Works as a thief. She's just a girl, and she's quite a bit over her head in this. Anyone who found those books would be in a position of enormous power."
"Or end up dead," Brennan said.
"Pray go on," Chrysalis said. "I'm all ears."
"You've probably guessed the rest," Brennan said. "Maybe you don't want to mention the name. It's a dangerous name, therefore very valuable."
"Say it," Chrysalis said.
"Kean," Brennan said. "I'm convinced Loophole is working for Kean. Something must have happened. Something big."
If Loophole is that desperate for the book, it must be something of Kian's, something really important, something damaging. And if the Shadowfist Society is Kian, they could be everywhere. He stood up. This is where we part ways, my friend.
Fortunato took his hand.
Thanks. If I find out anything about those books, I'll let you know.
Good luck,
Brennan said.
By the time he hit the front door, he was running.
Chrysalis leaned across the table. This demise, is he valuable to you, then?
If he can take me to the astronomer, he is.
Why can't you use your powers to find this astronomer for yourself?
They're no good against him. He's got me jammed like they used to jam radar with tinfoil. I couldn't even see him if he was standing right over there.
He pointed, and Chrysalis, her eyes suddenly afraid, turned slowly to follow his finger. No, she said. No one there.
Fortunato was no longer looking at her. He was building up the image of a tall, grotesquely thin man with brown hair and a ravaged face. If demise was close enough, within a few blocks, Fortunato could find him just by concentrating. He opened his eyes.
Canal Street, he said. The subway.
Chapter 5. 10 a.m. By the time he got into the crooked, winding streets of the West Village, Jack had started to wonder whether he should cross over toward the east side and Jokertown, or continue down toward what was clearly the center of action in the city today, Jet Boy's tomb. At least he was in more familiar territory now. Spotting a familiar facade on Greenwich, he fumbled in his breast pocket and found the creased color snapshot Elouette had sent him the previous Christmas. Obviously, Cordelia had blossomed, but the likeness would suffice. The bar was called the Young Man's Fancy. It was a sort of social were-creature. From its opening first thing in the morning, it was a solid, blue-collar, working-class joint. Then, about 6 in the evening, it underwent a shift switch and utter sea change. All night, Young Man's Fancy was a gay bar. Whatever its guise, the Fancy was one of the oldest businesses in the village. Jack took the 3 steps in one and swung open the door. It was dark inside, and his eyes took their time adjusting. He crossed the width of the rectangular room, hearing peanut shells crunch under his size 11s. The bartender looked up from polishing a tray of bud glasses. Help you?
Maybe you were looking out the window this morning, said Jack. He held up the photograph. You see her?
You a cop?
Jack shook his head.
Didn't think so.
The bartender scrutinized the picture.
Mighty pretty girl. Your woman?
Jack shook his head again.
Niece.
Right, said the bartender.
He scrutinized Jack more closely.
Ain't I seen you in here about 6?
Probably, said Jack. I come here. The girl in the picture. Have you seen her this morning?
The bartender squinted thoughtfully.
Nope.
He looked appraisingly at Jack.
Reckon she really is your niece, huh? Lost, strayed, or stolen?
Stolen.
Jack scribbled a number on a ham's napkin. Vagabond had given him Rosemary's direct office line.
Do me a favor, okay? You see her. Whether she's alone or with someone else, leave a message here.
He headed for the door.
Appreciate it, he said back over his shoulder.
Gotcha, said the bartender. Day or night, anything for a customer.
She had the cabbie drop her at Freaker's. The club was jumping even at 10:20 in the morning, and the doorman who handed her out of the cab looked as if he were already 2 or 3 sheets to the wind. His soft white fur was rumpled, and his red eyes were both bleary and bright at the same time. He indicated the door to the club, but Roulette merely shook her head and headed off toward the Crystal Palace, and nearly jumped out of her skin when the double doors crashed open and a long line of conga-dancing jokers came undulating into the street from between the neon thighs of the 6-breasted stripper that adorned and formed the club's door. Leading the line was a beautiful-faced woman who was having no trouble with the sinuous curves of the dance, since from the neck down she had the body of an iridescent snake. Her tail, which ended in an incongruous tuft of feathers, was uplifted and the joker immediately behind her in the line had a firm grip on the tip. He wasn't wearing a mask, but he was one of the few. The rest of the swaying, yelling, shouting crowd were a variety of dominoes, from elaborate feather-jeweled and sequin creations to hideous visages that were worse than the deformities they hid. Perhaps. At the tail end of the line clung a few gnats, looking both excited and self-conscious, and a touch belligerent, as if daring the jokers who inhabited the Bowery and provided a wealth of skin-crawling, spine-tingling entertainment for the tourists to object. For a moment, Roulette hated the thrill-seekers with their bland, normal faces and smug security. "I hope it is catching," came the vicious thought. "God damn you all." But the thought was really meant for Josiah. Josiah, who had sworn to love and care for her, and instead had abandoned her when she most needed him. Apparently, white liberal guilt wasn't enough to deal with a woman who had the wild card virus. Might be catching. And she could imagine her former mother-in-law seated in prissy splendor at her Newport mansion, sipping tea and discussing how, no matter how much you worked with one of those black girls, it so often went to naught. Many times they were simply too badly warped and scarred, both mentally and physically, by the white man's oppression to enter white society. Wasn't it a shame? Sigh. But she probably burnt the sheets and had every piece of furniture in the house recovered after Josiah divorced me. Sanctimonious, hypocritical bitch. Roulette realized that she had been walking blindly, shouldering past the throngs that filled the streets of Jokertown. The sound of hammers and staple guns echoed in the already sultry morning air, shouts of greeting and insult from the jokers busy setting up booths for the day-long party. The smell of cooking, good and bad, wafting over the exhaust-laden air. Overhead, a small private plane droned by, pulling a long banner that read, "Jokers into Aces. Results guaranteed. Call 555-9448. On another corner, the Church of Jesus Christ Joker had a booth already up and running, handing out literature to anyone who could be stopped. Their results were guaranteed too, but in the afterlife. Beset on all sides, thought Roulette, charlatans for the here and the hereafter. Hopeless hope. Well, my people can tell you all about that, and it never gets any easier until there's some new and even more unpopular minority to take your place. And I can't conceive of a more unpopular and hideous minority than the jokers ever arising, you poor bastards." There was a barricade across Henry Street. It wasn't legal, but Chrysalis was a major figure in Jokertown, and the area precinct had reason to be grateful to the owner of the Crystal Palace. More than one tough case had been solved because of her intervention, so the chief wasn't about to raise a stink over a few traffic snarls once a year. Chrysalis also had control of street decorations, so Henry Street projected an image of tasteful pride rather than the garish shock value that held sway on other streets. Roulette slipped past the barricade and started down the street. To her right, and for about half the length of the block, there was an empty lot filled with piles of rubble, a reminder of the Jokertown riot back in 76. Waist-high weeds and a few hardy saplings thrust up through the brick and plaster mounds. Several of the piles had dark openings like yawning little mouths, and she wondered if the place had become a haven for animals. She couldn't picture the fastidious Chrysalis allowing a rat warren to grow up next door to her bar. As she watched, there was a gleam from deep in the hole that soon resolved itself into a pair of bright eyes surrounded by hair. But it wasn't the shy muzzle of an animal that peered from the burrow. It was human, sort of. With a gasp, Roulette ducked her head and hurried on, passing Arachne, whose 8 slender legs caught at the line of silk extruding from her bulbous body and wove it swiftly into one of her famous spider silk shawls. Her daughter was busy in their booth hanging out an array of delicately dyed scarves and shawls. Most gnats would never have purchased one of the trembling, almost transparent scraps of fabric if they had seen it being created. But Arachne made a good living supplying the scarves to Sax and Neiman Marcus. Roulette owned one, a delicate peach-colored creation that looked like she had thrown a sunset over her dark shoulders. If she had known Arachne was going to be on Henry Street, she would have worn it to show the woman that she, at least, did not mind the source, and that she honored the artistry. There was a low rumbling that gained in speed and intensity and ended with a crashing boom as Elmo, the palace's resident bouncer, rolled another metal keg of beer out of the front door and into the street, where it joined its brethren like a rotund queue slamming into a setup of stumpy balls. The bouncer, who looked rather like a beer keg himself, flexed his shoulders in satisfaction and headed back for another one. Kids darted up and down the pavement chasing a battered soccer ball, while at the far end of the block an impromptu baseball game had begun. Ghetto blasters throbbed out a cacophony of conflicting music. Soul, rock, country, classical. Children cried and mothers called, but this madness had a sense of serenity and security, a feeling of family. Nowhere did she sense that desperate and nerve-stretching drive to have fun that had gripped the dancing throng outside Freakers. These people, as hideous as many of them were at peace with themselves. Roulette tore her eyes from the gang of playing urchins and forced herself to scan the crowd for a distinctive, tiny red-headed figure. 30 minutes ago, she had stopped at the Jokertown Clinic, only to be told by Tachyon's very cool, very elegant, very beautiful, and very disapproving chief of surgery that the good doctor was not present, but could no doubt be found making house calls at any one of a number of bars. Roulette had tried Ernie's and Wally's and the Funhouse with no luck, and now the Crystal Palace. And she found him. Seated at a small table among many other small tables that had been squeezed into the sidewalk out front of the palace, Brandy Snifter held lightly between long, slender fingers, glass tilting softly so the amber liquid flowed gracefully about the sides. Another glass figure standing at his left shoulder, but this one filled with the bone and viscera that form a human being. Long nails painted an iridescent pink, a dusting of silver-blue glitter across one unseen cheek. Chrysalis herself. Roulette had reached the moment. She hadn't thought beyond simply finding the Takesian, but now having found him, what did she do? Faint? Sprain an ankle? She knew, as did most of the world, of the alien's fascination with beautiful women. But there were lots of beautiful women in New York, and what if he had already found a companion for the day? And if he hadn't, how could she ensure that he picked her? Beauty she had, but not the skills that usually accompanied it. She had never mastered the art of flirting, and in that moment she felt a surge of relief. She would walk past. If he noticed, well, so be it. He was meant to meet his fate. If not, she tried not to think of the wizened little man lurking in his damp lair. She focused her eyes on the barricade and began to count her steps, noting how the crepe rubber soles of her shoes seemed to spring away from the concrete, and the way her slacks whispered against her ankles, and the brush of her braided hair against, "I think you're a fool." Chrysalis bit off the words in her clipped British way. "Every year you start out here having your first brandy of the day, remain sober long enough to get through your speech, begin soaking up beer at the game, maintain your liquid diet right through Hiram's dinner. And then, to put a perfect cap on the day, you end up back here, blind drunk, guilty and miserable, Why don't you take my advice and... And every year you give me the same advice, Tachyon said in a lilting counterpoint. Go to Miami, they concluded in chorus. Tachyon's smile faded. How could I leave this dreadful news about Howler and not a clue as to his murderer? And you're not a cop. Leave it to the professionals. A stubborn shake of his head. Tacky, it's not necessary for you to take part in this annual celebration of the grotesque. Jokertown knows you care. We won't hate you for being absent for 1 out of 365 days. But not this day. I have to be here. His throat worked at gulping down another large swallow of the brandy. It's my penance. His voice husky, perhaps from the effects of the brandy. You're a fool, Chrysalis said again softly, and gave his shoulder a hard squeeze with one transparent hand. Roulette, staring in fascination at the white finger bones against the deep ruby material of Tachyon's coat, had a dislocating image of death capering beside the man. Slowly she brought her hand up before her face and steadied it, the way the tendons shifted beneath the café au lait skin, the half-moons of pale white beneath the buffed nails, the tiny scar on the index finger where she had cut herself during a cooking lesson when she was only 6. Then looked back to Chrysalis, now disappearing through the door of the palace, and thought, I should look like her. I'm death. Cool touch against the bruised skin of her face, an anchor, she gasped, and her eyes flew open and she looked down into the concerned pale lilac eyes of the Tachesian. Madam, are you all right? You look like you're about to faint. Yes, no, I'm fine, she babbled. The strength of the arm about her was at odds with his delicate features. Here, sit down. The metal edge of the chair caught at the back of her knees, and she sprawled and realized how close she had been to fainting. The brandy snifter was pressed into her hands. No, it's an accepted, if somewhat old-fashioned, remedy for faintness. Her wits were returning, and she straightened in the chair. And I'm old-fashioned enough to consider it far too early in the day for brandy? She watched in astonishment as a wave of red washed across his thin face and the red lashes lowered to hide the chagrin in those purple eyes. Tachyon hurriedly removed the glass and set it well away from both of them as if abjuring the alcohol. You're right. Chrysalis is right. It's far too early in the day for me to be imbibing. What would you like? Some fruit juice? I just realize I haven't had anything but coffee today. Well, that clearly won't do and can be easily rectified. A moment, please. He bounded from his chair and hurried into the palace. And Roulette rested her head on a hand and tried to readjust her thinking. Or perhaps truly thought for the first time. The man who had ruined her life had been a hazy outline. For one thing, she hadn't expected him to be quite so tiny, or to have a smile of such sweetness, or a quaint courtesy that seemed more appropriate to an 18th-century drawing room. And Hitler loved children and small animals, she reminded herself. Her eyes settled on one of the ball players, a small boy whose bloated body rested on narrow, webbed feet, and whose flipper arms flapped in excitement as the ball was pitched. The crime is too monstrous, and his death will ease not only my suffering. He was back, depositing a glass of orange juice before her. He watched while she sipped, tipped back in the chair, booted feet propped on the table. He seemed comfortable with the silence, which was not a thing she was accustomed to in men. Most seemed to need a constant babble from the women around them, as if in reassurance of their importance. Better? Much. The front legs of the chair crashed down. Since introductions would now seem in order, I'm Dr. Tachyon. Roulette, Brown, Roxbury. Roulette, he repeated, giving it its French pronunciation. Unusual name. She twirled the glass, leaving a circle of condensation on the table. There's a story behind it. She glanced over and found his eyes resting with unsettling interest on her face. My mother was allergic to most birth control devices, so my parents settled for the rhythm method. Dad said it was like playing Russian roulette. And when the inevitable happened, they decided to call me Roulette.
Charming. Names should say something about the person or about their background. They're like stories that get added to with each successive generation. But I've said something to offend you.
Roulette forced her features back into an expression of calm. No, not at all. She returned to her contemplation of the condensation ring, and silence settled softly over them, making the cries of the children and the pounding of hammers all the louder. Doctor?
Madam?
They both began together and fell back into their chairs, embarrassed. Please, she gestured toward him. Go ahead.
I was wondering what brought you into Jokertown on this day. You lack the guilty curiosity or the morbid hunger that motivates most normals.
I've come to journey a bit farther in despair, she heard herself say, and that darker part of her soul cursed her for a fool. What man would want to spend the day with a morbid and lachrymose woman? His hand closed over hers, tightening about the fingers, and pain seemed to flow between them.
Then let us journey together. If you would like, he added quickly, as if fearful to offend, this day is difficult for me. It would be easier in your company.
I have no comfort to give.
I ask for none, only for your company.
His fingers brushed lightly across her bruised cheek. And perhaps, if you wish, I might comfort you. Perhaps. And in her secret place, death reveled. Just a little.
People crushed into him from all directions. The sidewalks were jammed with costumed jokers and rubbernecking gnats. He moved the same speed and direction as the crowd, letting it carry him along. There was no point in calling attention to himself. The astronomer could be anywhere, and usually was. Spectre didn't need to be at Times Square for over an hour. He didn't want to show up early. It might make him appear over-eager. The Jokertown parade was the safest place he could think of to kill time. In the street, a band started playing Jokertown Strutter's Ball. Spectre was beginning to feel claustrophobic. He picked his way toward the edge of the crowd. A three-eyed mime wearing white tights blocked his path and signaled him to stop. Spectre tensed. The mime frowned in an exaggerated manner, then stepped aside and motioned him past. Spectre gave him a hard elbow in the stomach. He smiled as the Joker doubled over. He hated mimes. Spectre was thankful for his constant pain. It distracted him enough that he couldn't focus on the smell of hundreds of sweating jokers. By the end of the day, plenty of gnats would be green from the dead fish scent. Spectre looked at his digital watch. He'd taken it from a young broker he'd killed in the financial district the week before. It was only a little past 10:30. The day, like the parade, was crawling slowly by. He hadn't been this afraid since the first time he'd met the astronomer. The old man had told him they'd rule the world, that he'd be a top dog in the new order. It was all bullshit. The local aces had stepped in and ruined everything. At least the astronomer was going to get them, too. I hope he makes it last when he's doing tachyon, Spectre thought. He reached the edge of the crowd and ducked into an alley. Garbage was littered about in large piles. 3 steps in, he heard the howl. Spectre stopped and looked up. The astronomer, smiling, was floating down toward him.
I told you what would happen, Demise. You had your chance.
The astronomer howled again, a throaty, inhuman bellow. Spectre turned and ran back into the crowd, pushing past people, knocking them down. He ignored their threats and curses and fought his way into the street. He dodged through the startled band members, then ran past a crepe float off the turtle and into the mass of people on the other side. He was afraid to look back. A policeman grabbed him by the arm. Spectre kneed him in the crotch and pulled away. People all around him were screaming. He could barely breathe.
I'm right behind you.
The astronomer's voice was close. Spectre turned. The astronomer was hovering by the policeman who had raised his pistol to fire. Blue light leapt from the astronomer's right hand, connecting with the weapon. The gun exploded, showering the policemen and spectators with shrapnel. More screams. Spectre tripped over a trash basket and fell hard to the concrete sidewalk, skinning his hands. He stood slowly, his knees wobbling. He felt hands grip his shoulders, fingers digging powerfully into his flesh. He couldn't pull away. No. Spectre's voice sounded just like Gruber's had earlier. The astronomer let go with one hand and grabbed the top of his head.
Look at me when I speak to you, Demise.
Spectre felt his head being spun around. There was a stab of unbearable pain, a snap, and his mouth filled with blood. The astronomer grinned at him.
It's Judgment Day.
Noise ran through the crowd behind them. The astronomer turned away, distracted by something, dropping Spectre like a sack of garbage. His body was paralyzed. He couldn't break the fall. Spectre landed face first on the sidewalk, smashing his mouth and nose. He watched the pool of blood widen around his open mouth. It was time to die again. At least he wouldn't have to see or feel what was going to happen to him.
Side by side and bumper to bumper, the floats took up a block and a half of Center Street, south of Canal. Fortunato could see Dez, the elephant-faced joker, done up in chicken wire and flowers. There was Dr. Todd's blimp and Jet Boy's plane behind it, complete with floral speed lines. A clear plastic balloon of chrysalis floated overhead. This was deep Joker Town, and there weren't so many tourists here. The tourists that came this far down didn't bring their kids. Drivers in coveralls stood by the floats, smoking and talking to each other. The worst of the crowd seemed to all be moving the same way as Fortunato, toward something that was happening up ahead. Half a block away, he could see the lines of power in the air, like heat waves shimmering, distorting everything around them. It was a signature that wasn't really a signature, a set of psychic eraser marks. He'd seen them for the first time 17 years ago, in a dead boy's room not far from here, where women had been brutally cut to pieces as part of a conspiracy that ended with the great, devouring monstrosity of Tiamat orbiting the sun. He was lightheaded and his pulse was going crazy. He realized that he was scared. Really, honest to Christ, terrified for the first time in 17 years. He sent a wedge of power out in front of him and ran toward the place where the lines came together. People spun away on both sides of him, shouting at him but unable to touch him. Demise screamed. Even over the noise of the crowd, Fortunato could hear the crunch of mangled bone and cartilage and the thud of a body hitting the sidewalk. As he broke through the wall of people, they were already turning, trying to get away. Somebody dragged away a wounded cop. His right hand burned black, his face pocked with blood. There was a 10-foot circle of sidewalk, empty except for Demise. Demise lay on his back. the lapels of his gray suit and the open collar of his scruffy shirt exposed. His head was turned completely around, his face flat against the pavement. Blood ran out of his mouth and nose. A man in the crowd was screaming,
"There! He's right over there! He's getting away! Stop him, for God's sake!"
He was pointing at nothing at all. All Fortunato could see was a blur of faces, like he was trying to look too far to one side, even though he was staring straight ahead. "Jamming me," he thought. He focused his power and slowed time until the man's voice and the moans of shock and disgust around him dropped to a subsonic rumble. A tornado of psychic energy hung in the frozen chaos around him. Demise's power, Fortunato's own, the viral energy of the Joker's. It was hopeless. He let go, and time came up to speed. There was nothing he could do. Demise was dead. It was not much of a loss. Most of what he knew about Demise was second or third hand, picked up from cops and bystanders after the riot at the Cloisters. He was a loser, a middle-class failure who'd caught the wild card and died of it in Tachyon's clinic. Tachyon brought him back, and Demise never forgave him for it. He'd come back a projecting telepath, so they said. And what he could project was the memory of his own death, strongly enough to kill with it. For a while he'd sat at the astronomer's right hand, until Fortunato and the others had destroyed their base at the Cloisters, and Fortunato had blasted their Shakti device into atoms. He'd have done the same for Demise and the astronomer if he'd been able, but now Demise seemed inconsequential. From a sense of wounded aesthetics, Fortunato got on one knee and twisted Demise's head the right way around. He was about to walk away when Demise said,
"Thanks. I needed that."
Fortunato turned back, his skin crawling. Demise squatted on his heels, rubbing the swollen purple lumps in his neck where blood vessels had burst. Already the bruises were turning yellow, healing as Fortunato watched. Demise smiled. His mouth was a little too long and thin, and it came up too high on one side. The smile was full of terror, and the man's hands shook so hard he held them up and laughed at them.
"Didn't know about that little trick, did you? I got my little black message I can send, and I got this other thing, too. Even the astronomer didn't know about it. I can heal, brother."
He hacked up a gob of blood, and it was a solid brown crust by the time it hit the sidewalk. "Then he thinks you're dead," Fortunato said.
"Christ, I hope so. Not that he wouldn't have gone ahead and ripped my heart out, just to be sure, if you hadn't shown up. Son of a bitch even told me he was going to do it. If I had stayed in Brooklyn, maybe I could have kept out of his way."
He coughed up another lump.
"If the dog hadn't stopped to piss, he would have caught the rabbit."
"Why does he want you dead?"
"Thinks I sold him out. All it was, after that shit at the Cloisters, I started thinking another line of work might be healthier."
Demise stared at him. There was a spark back there. Fortunato could see it. If not genius, at least some craft and cunning. Most people wouldn't see it because people didn't spend much time looking into Demise's eyes, one way or another. Behind the spark was something else. Fortunato had seen it before, 17 years ago, when he brought a dead boy back to life. It was the black despair of having looked at death too closely.
"In fact," Demise said, "I'm surprised he didn't take you out while he was here. Unless he's saving you for dessert."
"Dessert?"
"This is it, man. Judgment Day, he calls it. I'm gonna die. You're gonna die. Every one of you fuckers that hit him at the Cloisters is gonna die. And it's all coming down today. With all this other shit going down in Jokertown, he doesn't have to worry about cops or anybody else getting in his way."
Fortunato had a sudden hunch, a convergence of invisible power lines. You know anything about some stolen books, or a man named Kian?
You ask a lot of questions.
I just saved your life.
No. No to the books. No to whatever his name was.
He was telling the truth, but Fortunato still felt the connection. A man named Loophole or Latham.
Sorry. No dice.
Fortunato started to turn away.
Hey, listen,
Demise said.
I didn't mean to get snippy. Maybe you could hide me out for a while. Just till this time tomorrow.
Why tomorrow?
Just the way the man was talking. Parting shot and shit like that. I got a real strong sense that by tomorrow morning, you can color me gone. So what do you say? Got some place to stash me?
Don't push your luck, Fortunato said. Demise shrugged. The gesture was a little stiff, but otherwise his neck looked almost normal.
I guess I better turn up something on my own then, hadn't I?
The ice sculptures arrived at 10:30 in a refrigerated truck that had fought its way through the holiday crowds from the artist's loft in Soho. Hiram went down to the lobby to make certain that there were no mishaps as the life-size sculptures were transported up the service elevator. The artist, a rugged-looking joker with bone-white skin and colorless eyes who called himself Kelvin Frost, was most comfortable at temperatures around 30 below and never left the frigid comforts of his studio. But he was a genius in ice, or ephemeral art, as Frost and the critics preferred to call it. When the sculptures were safely stored in the Aces High walk-in freezer, Hiram relaxed enough to look them over. Frost had not disappointed. His detail was as astonishing as ever, and his work had something else as well. A poignancy, a human quality that might even be called warmth, if warmth could exist in ice. Hiram sensed something forlorn and doomed in the way Jet Boy stood there, looking up at the sky, every inch the hero, and yet somehow a lost boy too. Dr. Tachyon pondered like Rodan's the Thinker, but instead of a rock, he sat upon an icy globe. Cyclone's cloak billowed out so you could almost feel the wind skirling about him, and the Howler stood with legs braced and fists clenched at his side, his mouth open as if he'd been caught in the act of screaming down a wall. Peregrine looked as though she'd been caught in some other act. Her sculpture was a recumbent nude, resting languidly on one elbow, her wings half spread behind her, every feather rendered in exquisite detail. A sly, sweet smile lit that famous face. The whole effect was magnificently erotic. Hiram found himself wondering if she'd posed for him. It was not unlike her. But Frost's masterpiece, Hiram thought, was the turtle. How to bring humanity to a man who'd never once shown his face to the world, whose public persona was a massive armored shell studded with camera lenses. The artist had risen to that challenge. The shell was there, every seam and rivet, but atop it, in miniature, Frost had carved a myriad of other figures. Hiram walked around the sculpture, admiring, picking out detail. There were the four aces at some Last Supper, Golden Boy looking much like Judas. Elsewhere, a dozen jokers struggled up the curve of the shell, as if climbing some impossible mountain. There was Fortunato, surrounded by writhing, naked women, and there a figure with 100 blurred faces who seemed to be deep in sleep. From every angle, the piece unveiled new treasures. "Kind of a shame it's going to melt, isn't it?" Jay Ackroyd said from behind him. Hiram turned. "The artist doesn't think so. Frost maintains that all art is ephemeral, that ultimately it will all be gone. Picasso and Rembrandt, Van Gogh, the Sistine Chapel and the Mona Lisa, whatever you care to name, in the end it will be gone to dust. Ice art is therefore more honest, because it celebrates its transitory nature, instead of denying it." "Real good," the detective said in a flat voice, "but no one ever chipped a piece off the Pietà to put in their drink." He glanced over at Peregrine. "I should have been an artist. Girls always take their clothes off for artists. Can we get out of here? I forgot to bring my fur muumuu." Hiram locked the freezer and escorted Aykroyd back to his office. The detective was a nondescript sort of fellow, which was probably an asset in his profession. Mid-40s, slender, just under medium height, carefully combed brown hair, quick brown eyes, an elusive smile. You'd never look at him twice on the street, and if you did, you'd never be sure if you'd seen him before. This morning he wore brown loafers with tassels, a brown suit obviously bought off the rack, and a dress shirt open at the collar. Hiram had asked him once why he didn't wear ties. "Prone to soup stains," Aykroyd had replied. "Well?" Hiram asked, when he was safely ensconced behind his desk. He glanced up at his muted television. A color graphic was showing sound waves coming out of the mouth of a yellow stick man and knocking down a wall. Then they cut to an on-the-scene reporter speaking into the camera. Behind him, a dozen police cars cordoned off a brick building. The street was covered with shards of broken glass winking in the sunlight. The camera panned slowly over rows of shattered windows and the cracked windshields of nearby parked cars. "It was no big thing," Aykroyd said. "I nosed around the fish market for an hour and got the general idea fast enough. You've got your basic protection racket going down."
"I see," Hiram said.
"The waterfront draws crooks like a picnic draws ants. That's no secret. Smuggling, drugs, the rackets, you name it. Opportunities abound. Your friend Gills, along with most of the other small businessmen, paid the mob a percentage off the top, and in return the mob provided protection and occasional help with the police or the unions."
"The mob?" Hiram said.
"Jay, this sounds suitably melodramatic, but I had the impression that the mob was made up of ethnic gentlemen, partial to pinstripes, black shirts, and white ties."
The hoodlums who were troubling Gills lacked even that rudimentary fashion sense, and one of them was a joker. Has the mafia taken to recruiting jokers?
"No," Aykroyd said. "That's the trouble. The East River waterfront belongs to the Gambioni family. But the Gambionis have been losing their grip for years now. They've already lost Jokertown to the Demon Princes and the other Joker gangs, and a Chinatown gang called the Egrets or Snowbirds or something like that has run them right out of Chinatown. Harlem got taken away a long time ago, and the bulk of the city's drug traffic no longer flows through Gambioni hands. But they still control the waterfront. Until now." He leaned forward. "Now there's competition. They're offering new and improved protection at a much higher price. Maybe too high for your friend."
"His son is in college," Hiram said thoughtfully. "The tuition is quite substantial, I believe."
"So what I witnessed this morning was a little, dunning."
"Bingo," Aykroyd said. "If Gills and his fellow merchants have been paying the Gambionis for protection, why aren't they receiving it?"
2 weeks ago, a body was found hanging from a meat hook in a warehouse 2 blocks from Fulton Street. A gentleman by the name of Dominic Santarello. He was ID'd by fingerprints, his face having been beaten into ground round. A colleague of Santarello's, one Angelo Casanovista, turned up dead in a barrel of pickled herring a week prior. His head was not in the barrel with him. The word on the streets is that the new guys have something the Gambionis don't. An ace, or at least a joker who can pass for an ace in a bad light. Now these things do tend to get exaggerated, but I'm told he's 7 feet tall, inhumanly strong, and ugly enough to make you wet your pants. He goes by the charming nom de guerre of Bludgeon. The Gambionis are overmatched, I'd say." He shrugged. Hiram Worcester was aghast.
"And what about the police?"
"Gills is afraid. One of his friends tried talking to the police, and his body turned up with a flounder shoved down his throat. Literally. The cops are investigating."
"Well, this is intolerable," Hiram said. "Gills is a good man, an honest man. He deserves better than to have to live in this kind of fear."
"What can I do to help?"
"Lend him the money to make his payment," Aykroyd suggested with a cynical smile.
"You can't be serious," Hiram objected. The detective shrugged. "Better idea. Hire me to be his full-time bodyguard. Does he have a nubile daughter by any chance?" When Hiram didn't respond, Aykroyd got up and slid his hands into his jacket pocket. "All right. There might be something to be done. I'll work on it. Chrysalis might be able to tell me something useful, if the price is right." Hiram nodded and rose behind his desk.
"Fine," he said.
"Excellent. Keep me posted."
Aykroyd turned to go.
"One more thing," Hiram said. Jay turned back, raised an eyebrow. "This Bludgeon sounds, ill-tempered, to say the least. Don't do anything too dangerous. Be careful."
Jay Aykroyd smiled. If Bludgeon gives me any trouble, I'll dazzle him with magic, he said. He made a gun out of his fingers, three fingers folded back, index finger pointed at Hiram, thumb up straight like a hammer. Don't you dare, Hiram Worcester told him. Not if you want to eat tonight. Aykroyd laughed and slid his hand back into his pocket and sauntered out. Hiram glanced back at his television scene. They were running an interview with the Howler. The interviewer was Walter Cronkite, a 10-year-old clip Hiram realized from the Great Jokertown Riot of 1976. He changed the channel, hoping to see some coverage from Jokertown and Jet Boy's tomb, and perhaps get another glimpse of Peregrine. Instead, he got Bill Moyers doing a commentary in front of a large still photograph of the Howler. The Howler seemed to be much in the news this morning, Hiram thought. He was curious. He turned on the sound.
Chapter 6. 11 a.m. A parade in Jokertown was always a unique experience. No need to create some fantastic creature out of wire and flowers and paper. No, here the Jokers could provide all the grotesquerie required with just their miserable bodies. There was no Joker Queen either. Several years ago, they had tried to introduce the notion. Tachyon explained as he guided Roulette through the crowds. But he had been so revoluted by the notion that the planners had dropped the idea. There were a number of politically active jokers who hadn't forgiven him yet. Sarah Roosevelt Park had been cordoned off and was filled with belching, grinding flatbed trucks all carrying fantastic scenes on the utilitarian backs. Off to the west, a knot of sweating cops were demolishing a vast, double-headed phallus. Roulette noticed that a number of men in the crowd looked away each time a crowbar bit deep into the latex. To the west, the Joker Moose Lodge bagpipe band was tuning up. The braying of the pipe sounded harsh in the still, sultry air. "Are you the parade's grand master?" Roulette asked with more acid than she'd intended. No, Tachyon snapped back, and she found herself staring at his rigid back as he scanned the crowd. A portly joker, his nose replaced by a long trunk ending in several tiny fingers, broke from the edges of the crowd like a calving iceberg and chugged toward Tachyon. All set? He asked, thrusting out a hand. All set. Des, may I introduce Roulette Brown Roxbury? Roulette, Xavier Desmond, owner of the Fun House, and one of Jokertown's most sterling citizens. Some would argue that that's an oxymoron. My, we're crabby today, Tachyon teased with a touch of acid. A look passed between the two men, and Roulette realized that theirs was a complex relationship. They were friends. They respected one another, but something lay between them, a memory of ancient pain. This flash of cattiness had an unusual effect. Rather than strengthening her desire to kill the man, it somehow made him all the more charming. He was not perfect, or even perfectly evil, just human, and therefore understandable. And she cursed the insight, for it is easier to hate in the abstract. Des glanced at his watch. Running late as usual. I just hope delays in the heat don't conduce to any, shall we say, incidents. He tugged on his upper lip. I can't help but think of 76 when I see all these police. There was a strange feel on that day. Mercifully, we've never felt it since. Well, I'd best mingle. He caught up both of Roulette's hands and pressed a quick kiss onto each. I will be back to collect you before we get underway. Are you sure I should be with you? Maybe we could just meet for lunch afterward or something. Her voice trailed away. No, no, I need the support. Difficult situation. I beg your pardon? Roulette pulled her eyes from Tachyon's fast-vanishing form. If he doesn't take part in the parade, he's accused of showing contempt for the jokers and favoring the aces. When he does join in, which he's done for the past 5 years, he's accused of being a heartless parasite, living off the misery of the jokers he helped create, a little tin-plated king of his own freak kingdom. Her eyes roved the park, snow cone vendors hawking through the crowd, police with sweat stains in the pits and front of shirts. Tachyon like a tiny red-headed, red-clad devil in the Dante-esque scene as jokers doubled for demons. Just do the job and get out of this. That was all she wanted now. Somehow she had to pry him loose, seek the privacy of a hotel or apartment and make the kill. She couldn't cut him out yet. His sense of duty would keep him in this freak parade, and he was a featured speaker at the tomb. Her thoughts propelled her, carried her across the park toward the Takesian, while behind her Dez frowned over her abrupt departure. Perhaps a sudden indisposition? Stupid! All that would get her was a bed at the Jokertown Clinic. Definitely the wrong bed. Perhaps a use your goddamn body. Most men's brains seem to be lodged in their penises. His welcoming smile embraced her.
Ah, I think you must be a telepath. I was just coming for you.
Were you? She heard herself reply, but the voice seemed to be coming from a long distance. I hope you'll continue to come for me. Her arm slid around his neck, and molding her body to his, she pressed a kiss unto his mouth. For an instant there was withdrawal. Had she overplayed the moment? Then their tongues met, and all restraint was swept away. His tongue teased, thrust past the barrier of her teeth. His hand, hot against the nape of her neck, pulled her closer. A chorus of appreciative catcalls rose around them, and they broke apart. Well, Tachyon gusted, and pulling a handkerchief from a pocket, patted briskly at his forehead. She snuggled in close and pulled his arm through hers. I was very sad earlier. You've changed all that, and I wanted to thank you. Madam, Roulette, thank me any time you wish. A chauffeur, tail lashing at the ankles of his boots, held open the door of a large gray Lincoln.
Ah, Riggs, punctual as always. I often wonder how you tolerate me, for I am so notoriously unpunctual.
I've learned to bear with it. His voice was like soft velvet, and his luminescent green cat's eyes seemed lit from behind with amusement.
Riggs, this is Roulette Brown Roxbury. She is our guest for the day. A pinch to her fingers, and I hope into the night.
Riggs touched the bill of his cap. Ma'am?
So you employ jokers, she remarked as she slid across the leather upholstery.
Of course. And the reply struck her as smug. Riggs's reflexes and night vision are far superior to an ordinary human's. I'm very grateful to have my safety in his capable hands. The lead float was nosing majestically onto the Bowery. Behind it, PS-235's marching band swung into a snappy rendition of the Pineapple Rag. Senator Hartman's open car was next in line. An ace jogged beside the limo. At least Roulette presumed he was an ace. Most normal Secret Service agents didn't run about, dressed in white form-fitting jumpsuits, complete with black hood covering face and head. Hartman beamed and waved, every inch an elder statesman. Someone in the crowd lining the street shouted out,
"How about 88, Senator?"
"Suggest it. I'm ready,"
Hartman called back, and grinned as the laughter and cheers rippled through the throng. Two more floats, the mounted patrol, then Riggs put the big limo in gear, and they rolled out at a steady 10 miles per hour. "Why not an open car?" Roulette asked. And from overhead, a whining answered as the sunroof slid back. "I may have lived on Earth for 40 years, but I'm still a Takishan. I'm damned if I'm riding in an open car for anyone. And on wild card day, my enemies as well as my friends are abroad." 15 minutes later, and he dropped back onto the seat, fanning himself with his handkerchief. "Dreadful weather." "Here," she had been exploring while he had perched on the roof and waved to the crowd and had discovered the bar. "Dubonnet on ice. What an elegant lifesaver you are. Are you joining me this time?" "Yes." She moved in close, her thigh pressing against his. They each took a thoughtful sip. Then she ran one long nail down his cheek, noting the way his sideburns lay in red-gold whorls against his white, white skin. She paused and inspected the small isosceles-shaped scar on his pointed chin. "What happened?" "Combat training. Sajora and my father agreed we should leave it as a reminder to move more quickly next time." And his face closed down while tears of grief blurred his lilac eyes. It was the moment. She cupped his face between her hands and kissed him, her lips coaxing the rigidity out of his mouth. A tear splashed warmly on her hand as she licked the tiny point of moisture away. "Why so sad?"
"Because Sejur is dead, and my father, were he aware, would like to be. I think memory is a curse."
"Yes, so do I." Her hand slid down the satiny fabric of his waistcoat and gripped his waistband. His gasp played counterpoint to the rasp of the zipper. "So let's explore sensation in the moment and forget memories." She had him free now and was gently rolling his penis between the palms of her hands. He stiffened instantly, his back arching, and beads of sweat broke across his brow and upper lip.
"By the ideal woman, what are you doing?"
She gave him a Mona Lisa smile, took him in her mouth, and gave gentle suction. One hand shot out and hit the control, raising the window between them and Riggs. He moaned as her tongue teased at the underside of his glands.
"Have mercy!"
he groaned, one hand twisting in her braids.
"All right." She drew back. "The ideal. You leave me like this."
"Then let's go somewhere."
"The speech."
"Afterwards."
"Oh, God!"
The subway car's metal wheels squealed as they pulled into Times Square. The doors hissed open, and Spectre got up, feeling better than he had all morning. The astronomer had to figure he was dead, and the old man was having a very busy day. There wouldn't be any time for second thoughts about him. He dug dried blood out from between his teeth for the fingernail and slipped through the standing passengers toward the door. A surge of people entering the car pushed him back. He shoulder-cut his way through them and out onto the platform in front of a couple trying to enter the car. The doors closed.
"Hey, man, you made us miss the train."
The man was young and Hispanic, with a snap-brim hat and purple pinstripe suit.
A girl was holding onto the sleeve of his sealskin coat. He pushed Spectre back and shook his head.
You goddamn space cakes! Can't go anywhere in this town without running into jerks. Don't worry, baby. There'll be another along a few minutes.
Spectre was looking at the girl. She was tall and slender, with dark hair and eyes. She was wearing a heavy metal t-shirt with the name Ferric Jagger on the front. The pimp was carrying a soft-sided floral print suitcase that was obviously hers. There was something about her that demanded attention. Spectre could have some real fun with this one. Not sex, he didn't do that. He'd like killing girls with the astronomer, though. It was the only thing that got Spectre off anymore. It would be a real charge to feel the life go out of this little number.
Hey, man, what you looking at?
The pimp pushed him again, hard. Spectre's hatred and pain clawed their way out. He stared hard into the pimp's eyes. The other man made a soft sound as the air went out of him and he collapsed onto the platform. People nearby looked uncomprehending at the body for a few moments. Then voices began to call out for a doctor. He tugged at his mustache, happy at the pimp's death. The girl was staring down at the body, but there were no screams. Not yet. He pulled the suitcase from the pimp's hand and smiled at the girl. New in town? I can show you a thing or two. Local sights, whatever you want. She pulled the suitcase from him and turned away. She didn't say a word. Spectre saw Transicop moving in. He sifted into the crowd. It was a shame about the girl, but overall, things were beginning to look a little brighter.
The Happy Hawker Pawn Shop was in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn on Washington Avenue and Sullivan Street. Juniper took a cab to within a few blocks of the address and walked the rest of the way. It was located among other small, family-run businesses, including a delicatessen, a clothing store, a shoe store, and a small pizzeria. Everything but the deli was closed, and the street around the pawn shop was virtually deserted. But down a couple of blocks and across the street, a large crowd was gathered outside Ebbets Field for the Dodgers' annual Wild Card Day game. According to the sign across the main gate, the Dodgers were playing the Los Angeles Stars. The teams were old rivals, and since the Dodgers were in the midst of another close pennant race, it looked like the crowd already streaming into the stadium would stretch the seating capacity of the old ballpark to its limit. Juniper glanced at her wristwatch. It was a few minutes after 11. Tom Seaver, who'd been pitching for the Dodgers for almost all of Juniper's life, was scheduled to go against Fernando Valenzuela, the star's young Mexican hurler. There was still time to get tickets, and watching the ball game would be a more pleasant way to spend the afternoon than lunching with Gruber. She peered through the dusty window of the pawn shop. If she hadn't known better, she'd have thought that it was closed, along with most of the other small stores on the block. But Gruber had never broken an appointment with her before. She tried the front door. It was unlocked, and she went in. Inside the pawn shop, it was dark and still, its narrow aisles and tall shelves crammed with unwanted merchandise, most of which had been around since the time of Gruber's father, always gave Juniper a touch of claustrophobia. Guitars with broken strings, televisions with burned-out tubes, toaster ovens with frayed electrical cords, stained and torn coats and shirts and dresses crowded the shelves in the dingy room. The ink on their pawn tags faded to illegibility. The only light in the room came from a naked bulb dangling from electrical wires in the cage behind the counter, Gruber's customary lair. But Gruber wasn't there. She called out his name, but her words echoed hollowly, and she had a sudden feeling of wrongness. She walked closer to the cage, and the sole of her right shoe stuck in something tacky, like a blob of chewed-out gum. She looked down. A puddle of thick, rich liquid flowed out from one of the aisles. She took a step forward and peered around the edge of the shelving into the aisle and stared. It was Gruber. His pale, soft face was frozen into a rictus of intense horror. His pale, soft hands were clutched tightly to his stomach, but they hadn't prevented his blood from running out and collecting around him in a sticky, shallow pool. Jennifer hung over a low counter that was filled with cheap jewelry and cheaper guns and lost her breakfast. She leaned shakily against the glass counter after vomiting up everything in her stomach, letting it take her weight. After a moment or two of utter blankness, she wiped her lips and forced herself to look back at what was left of Gruber. It was the first body she'd ever seen. She stared in fascinated horror, thinking she ought to do something, but not knowing what. "It's her!" A hissing, sibilant voice sounded behind her, starting her heart jumping like that of an aerobic instructor on speed. She whirled around in a half-crouch and stared at the three men who had silently entered the shop through the back entrance. Two were Norms, or looked to be. The third was a Joker, a tall, slim man who looked like a lizard walking on two legs. He was the one who had spoken. Jennifer stared at him, and his long, forked tongue rolled out of his mouth again and flickered at her. "She's the one," he hissed. "Get her!" "Christ," one of the others muttered. "She killed him." The two Norms looked at each other uneasily, and Jennifer's brain finally began to work again. She recognized the reptilian Joker. He had been in Kian's condo. He had shown up when the Joker in the jar started screaming. How'd he trace her here? She glanced at Gruber's corpse. Gruber was a possibility, but she'd never be able to ask him if he'd turned her in. But how would he have known she'd stolen the stuff from Kian? This was no time to worry about it. The men with the reptiloid had just about convinced themselves to tackle her. They approached her slowly, pistols out, while the Joker stood by watching. Jennifer ghosted. She stepped out of her clothes, conserving only the bikini that she normally wore and the small bag that had the books in it. She glanced back over her shoulder as she stepped through a shelf crammed with hawked junk. The two Norms stared at her with open mouths. The Joker cursed with a hissing sibilance. She kept going through the shelves, the wall, and the alley between the pawn shop and the next building, leaving the men far behind. She caught her breath, metaphorically, and then solidified. She was in the clothing store. She grabbed a pair of jeans, a blouse, and sneakers, threw them on, stopped to take two 20s from her bag and put them into the cash register, and then fled through the front door. Kian's men were nowhere in sight. They were, she suspected, baffled by her disappearance, but she couldn't count on their bewilderment to last for very long. She looked down the street. To the right was Ebbets Field, still filling with baseball fans. To the left was Prospect Park, with an inviting offer of greenery and isolation. Somehow, though, she felt like being around other people. She'd be safe around people. No one could try to kill her. She'd have time to think things out. She ran down the street and joined the end of the line filing into the stadium just as Kian's men came around the far end of the block, shaking their heads in exasperated anger.
They crowded into Hiram's office, all of them. The cleaning crew, the dishwashers, the kitchen staff, even the electrician who'd come up to fix the faulty wiring in one of the chandeliers. They sat in the chairs, on the floor, on the desk and cabinets. Many stood. No one said a word. Even Paul LaBarre was silent. All eyes were on the television. Geraldo Rivera was interviewing one of the Howler's sisters. Hiram hadn't known the Howler had a sister. It turned out he had four of them. It was like the day Kennedy had been shot, he thought, or the day of the wild card, the first one 40 years ago, when Jet Boy had died and the world had changed forever. The newscast cut to a police press conference. Hiram listened and felt sick. Jesus! That was Peter Chow, the slim, quiet man who was in charge of Aces High Security. Peter, who collected depression glass and black belts in assorted martial arts and who never raised his voice or used profanity. Jesus fucking Christ, he said now. Nerve toxin. Jesus fucking Christ. Well, it don't make sense, one of the dishwashers said. Man, it don't make no fucking sense, man. That fucker could scream down walls. I saw him do it, man. I saw him. Then everybody started talking at once. Curtis tapped Hiram's shoulder, gave him a questioning look, and nodded toward the door. Hiram rose and followed him. The floor seemed cavernous and empty now, with everyone jammed into Hiram's office. Outside, Hiram said. They went out onto the sunset terrace and stood looking down over the city. The Empire State's public observation deck was on the floor above them, and above that was the old mooring mast that had once been intended for zeppelins. But except for that, there was no higher spot in New York City or the world. The sun shone down brightly, and Hiram found himself wondering if the sky had looked as blue to Jet Boy on the day he died. "The dinner," Curtis said simply. "Do we go ahead or cancel?" "We go on," Hiram said without hesitating. "Very good, sir," Curtis said. His tone was carefully neutral, neither approving nor disapproving. But Hiram felt he needed to explain. He put his hands up against the stone parapet, gazed off blindly to the west. "My father," he said, his voice sounded strange and halting, even to himself. "He was a robust man, as large as myself in his later years. He was a man of healthy appetites." "British, wasn't he?" Curtis said. Hiram nodded. "He fought at Dunkirk. After the war he married a wack and came to America. A male war bride he called himself, not that he wore white. He'd always had that, and my mother would always blush, and he would laugh. God, but that man could laugh. He roared. He did everything in a large way. Food, liquor, even his women. He had a dozen mistresses. My mother didn't seem to mind, although she would have preferred a tad more discretion. He was a loud man, my father." Hiram looked at Curtis. "He died when I was 12. The funeral was, well, the sort of function my father would have loathed. If he hadn't been dead, he never would have attended. It was grim and pious and so quiet. I kept expecting my father to sit up in the casket and tell a joke. There was weeping and whispering, but no laughter, nothing to eat or drink. I hated every second of it." "I see," Curtis said. "I have it in my will, you know," Hiram said. "A certain sum has been set aside, a rather handsome sum, I might add, and when I die, Aces High will open its doors to my friends and family, and the food and drink will keep flowing until the money is gone, and perhaps there will be laughter. Perhaps. I don't know Howler's wishes in that regard, but I do know that he could eat and drink with the best of them, and he was the only man I ever knew who laughed louder than my father." Curtis smiled. "He shattered several $1,000s worth of crystal with one of his laughs, as I recall." Hiram smiled, and wasn't the least bit abashed either. "Tachyon was the one who'd made the witticism, and of course he felt so guilty I didn't see his face for almost 3 months." Hiram clapped a hand on Curtis's shoulder. "No, I cannot believe that Howler would have wanted us to cancel the party. We go on, most definitely." "The ice sculpture?" Curtis reminded him gently. "We will display it," Hiram said firmly. "We're not going to try and pretend that Howler never existed. The sculpture will remind us that one of us is missing tonight." Somewhere far below, a horn was blaring. A man was dead, an ace, one of the fortunate handful. But the city went on as always, and as always someone was late for something. Hiram shivered. "Let's get it done, then." They went back inside. Peter Chow was crossing the floor in their direction. "You have a phone call," he said to Hiram. "Thank you," Hiram said. He went back into his office. "I know all of you are interested in the news," he told his staff. "So am I. But in a few hours we'll be feeding 150-odd people. We'll pipe in the latest bulletins, rest assured. Now let's get back to work." One by one they filed out. Paul LeBar put a hand on Hiram's shoulder before shuffling past. On television, Senator Hartman stood in front of Jet Boy's tomb, promising a full-scale investigation of the Howler's murder. Hiram nodded, touched the mute button, and picked up his phone. At first, he didn't recognize the voice, and the fragmentary words spoken with so much difficulty didn't seem to make much sense. The man kept apologizing over and over, and he was saying something about gasoline, and Hiram couldn't seem to focus on any of it. "What are you talking about?" "Lops. Lobsters," the voice said. "What?" Hiram said. He sat bolt upright. "Gills, is this you?" It certainly didn't sound like him.
"Sorry. Sorry, Hiram."
He began to wheeze. Then someone took the phone away from him.
"Good morning, fat boy,"
said a voice, strange and shrill, a voice like a razor blade scratching down a blackboard.
Gills don't talk so good. He's still spitting our teeth.
Hiram heard someone laugh in the background.
What Fishface is trying to tell you is that we just got done marinating your fucking lobsters in fucking gasoline, and if you want him, you can fucking well come down here and pick him up yourself, 'cause his fucking truck is on fire.
Another laugh.
Now listen good, asshole. I don't care if you are a fucking uptown ace, you cunt face. You fuck around with me, this is what you get. You listening?
There was a moment of dead air, and then a scream and a sharp sound like a bone breaking.
Hear that, cunt face?
The razor blade voice said. Hiram didn't reply.
Did you fucking hear it?
The voice screamed. Yes, Hiram said.
Have a nice day,
the voice said, followed by a click. Hiram slowly returned the phone to its cradle. The day could not possibly get any worse, he thought. Then the phone rang again.
Fortunato picked up the phone and dialed a Brooklyn extension. As soon as he was sitting down, the cat got in his lap and began kneading the legs of his jeans. The phone rang twice, and a woman answered. "Hello, is Arnie there?" he asked. He could have sent his astral body, but he was already running on about half a charge, and it was time to save his strength.
"No, this is his mother. May I help?"
"My name is Fortunato."
"Oh, heavenly days. I've heard Arnie talk about you forever. He'll just die when he finds out you called and he wasn't home."
"If you could just tell me where he is, ma'am, I'll try and find him myself."
"Oh, he's headed for Jet Boy's tomb. His father takes him down there every wildcard day. They left about an hour ago. I don't know if you'll be able to find him in all those crowds. He's not in any trouble, is he?"
"No, ma'am. Nothing like that. I'm sure I'll be able to find him."
"Oh, that's right. I guess you do have your ways, don't you? It's just that I'm a little nervous, what with the howler and all."
"The howler?"
"Oh, you haven't heard? Oh, dear. They found the howler just a little while ago. He was murdered. Some kind of nerve poison or something. It was just on the TV."
Fortunato hung up. He'd written the list on paper, just to focus his thoughts. The aces who had been at the Cloisters. Kid Dinosaur, Tachyon, Peregrine, the Turtle, Modular Man, the Howler, Jumpin' Jack Flash, Waterlily. He crossed the Howler's name off the list. So it was true, he thought. It wasn't just Demise's raving. It was happening, had already started. Of the ones that were left, Flash and the Turtle could take care of themselves. Tachyon couldn't, but that was Tachyon's problem. He called Hiram at Ace's High. He didn't think Hiram would be on the astronomer's hit list. He'd only been involved peripherally with the Tiamat business, and hadn't been at the Cloisters at all. Still, he deserved a warning. He told the story as simply as he could, and then said, "Listen, there's something you can do if you're willing. I need a command post. Somewhere safe to bring the ones I find, and somewhere for people to leave messages." "Of course. Nobody would attack Ace's High. It would be insane." "Right," Fortunato said. "But just in case, do you have some way of getting hold of that android, Modular Man?" "I think he gave me some kind of signal thing once. I could probably find him if I had to." "Just flatter him a little. I think that should do it. If not, you could subtly suggest that there'll be women there. If necessary, he can have one of mine. Just call and have one sent over on the house." He hung up before Hiram could change his mind. So what next? Try to find a kid he barely remembered out of thousands at Jet Boy's tomb, or move on down the list? No. The kid was reckless and stupid, and had just enough power to get himself in real trouble. It had to be the kid.
The game was almost sold out. Only bleacher seats were left by the time Jennifer got to the ticket window. but that was fine with her. She just wanted to sit down in the warm sun, let the reassuring sounds of the crowd wash over her, and think. She paid for her ticket, and some atavistic sense made her turn around and look behind. There was a man, moderately tall, slimly but strongly built, dark-haired, dark-eyed. He seemed to be watching her intently, but he looked away the moment after their eyes met. Her gaze lingered on him for a moment. He wore jeans, a t-shirt, and dark running shoes. The muscularity of his lithe build struck her. Then she was carried along the wave of ticket buyers into the stadium. Had he really been looking at her, or was she just getting paranoid? She let out a deep breath. It was probably her clothes that made him stare. She hadn't exactly had time to try on the clothing she'd taken. The pants were short and tight across her behind, and the pullover shirt was also short, leaving a couple of inches of her midriff peeking out. That was it. Her clothes. She was getting paranoid, picking out strangers in a crowd, thinking they were menacing her. Not that she didn't have a reason to be paranoid. After all, there were people after her. Now she just had to figure out why, and more importantly, how.
Spectre was tired of waiting. His anonymous contact had said 11:30, and it was already several minutes past that. Maybe they hadn't been satisfied with the way he'd handled Gruber. It wasn't his fault the idiot had pulled a gun. They couldn't have been stupid enough to think the bullets did it. He leaned against the statue of George M. Cohen and cracked his knuckles. He was aware of the bulge the Ingram was making in his coat. Most of the cops were in Jokertown, but the rest of the city had to be covered, too. It might be good to dump the gun now that the astronomer was off his tail. Then again, you never knew when an automatic pistol might come in handy. The crowd waiting in line for Broadway show tickets was smaller than usual. Spectre had never been to one. They seemed stupid and overpriced. He used to come over from Jersey on New Year's Eve to watch the ball drop at midnight. It was one of the few times he felt like a part of something bigger than just him. The neon signs around the square were washed out and dull during the day. If his connection didn't show up soon, he might pick up a whore for some fun. Seeing the tombstones rolled up in some cheap hooker's eyes would give him a few moments' relief from the pain. It wouldn't be great, like the girl in the subway, but it would be distraction. God, he'd wanted to kill her, at least hurt her enough to get a reaction out of her. Better to just get drunk and watch the ball game on television, though. A low profile for the rest of the day was not an entirely bad idea. Fuck it, he said, walking away from the statue. Those Shadow Fist boys are gonna have to do better than this. Don't go away mad, said a deep, nasty voice from behind. Spectre turned. There was a joker a few paces behind him, closing the distance with slow, measured strides. There was dried blood smeared on his shirt. He had a single eye set in the center of his forehead. You're late. It's been a busy morning. Had a little business to attend to down at the waterfront. The Cyclops made a fist, showing his badly bruised knuckles. You must be Spectre. Right. So tell me something. It's like this, he looked over his shoulder. The Gambionis are having dinner at the Haiphong Lily tonight. Family meeting, you know? The Don is in the way. He has to be taken care of. That's where you come in. Tonight, huh? What's the job pay? $5,000. Spectre ran his tongue around his teeth, cleaning away more dried blood. He figured this punk had been given a ceiling amount by someone higher up and could keep the rest for himself. The Joker didn't have the brains to snow a 6-year-old. No way. Do it yourself. Okay. 7-5. 10. Or get somebody else. We're not talking about an easy target here. This is the Don you want iced. Spectre took a step back and looked away. He wanted to push this guy hard. so the organization wouldn't take him for a fool. The Joker put his hands on his hips. You got it. I want two of that right now. Spectre extended his hand. What? Right here? You gotta be kidding. He glanced around again, this time in melodramatic fashion. Spectre had to bite his tongue to keep from laughing. This moron needed acting lessons and the brains to use them. They wouldn't send you here with just change in your pocket. Now pay up, or find me somebody who will. Spectre liked leaning on the punk a little, watching him squirm. The Cyclops pulled a thick brown envelope from his coat and shoved it in Spectre's face.
Just to show we trust you.
Spectre tucked the envelope in his coat pocket and smiled. I won't even count it. Yet. Now, what time is dinner for a friend at dawn?
Around 8. So you'll need to get there a little before. You can eat pretty well now, he said, tapping the envelope in Spectre's pocket.
When do I get the rest?
Tomorrow night. We'll let you know where.
He leaned in close, his breath stank of decay.
By the way, if you happen to hear anything about some missing stock books, let me know.
He pulled out a small spiral notebook and pen, then wrote a phone number on the top sheet.
You can reach me here for the next few hours, he said,
tearing out the sheet and handing it to Spectre.
It's the Bowery Wildcard Dime Museum. I do security work there, in my spare time.
You keep an eye on the place, right?
The Cyclops ignored his joke.
Hey, you have to have a legit job for tax reasons. That's what the boss says. Looks suspicious otherwise.
Sure, sure. What did you say your name was, just in case?
I.
And if I can't get hold of you?
Call the Twisted Dragon. Ask for Danny Mao. Tell him you were born in the year of the Fire Horse. He'll take it from there.
How would you like to come with me tonight, just so you'll be completely sure the contract was filled?
Spectre put his arm around the Joker and walked him down the sidewalk.
I shrugged him off. Just do your fucking job and keep your faggot hands off.
Pleasure doing business.
Spectre watched him walk away. There was time to hit a bar and watch the game before he went to work. The Dodgers had better fucking win today, or the Don would have plenty of company.
Chapter 7. 12 noon. The Dodgers were taking batting practice when Jennifer found her seat in the bleachers. The late summer sun was soothing on her bare arms and face. She closed her eyes and listened to the friendly sounds of the stadium, the call of the vendors, the conversation of the fans, the unmistakable crack of bat hitting ball. She suddenly realized that it had been 2 years since she'd been to a ball game, 2 years since her father had died. Her father had loved the Dodgers, and he'd taken her to many games. She wasn't that big a fan herself, but she'd always been happy to accompany him. It was a good excuse to get out into the sunshine or the cool evening air. She remembered, in fact, the first wild card day game her father had taken her to. It had been in 1969, the Dodgers against the Cardinals. The proud Dodger franchise had fallen on hard times in the mid-1960s, finishing at or near the bottom of the league for 5 straight years. But in 1969, the incomparable Pete Reeser, who had been in center field for the Dodgers that day in 1946 when the wild card virus had rained down from the sky, had come out of retirement to manage his old team. When Reeser played for the Dodgers, they'd been a collection of glorious names. In 1969, they were a bunch of cast-offs, never-has-beens, and untried rookies. Reeser, the center fielder nonpareil of the 40s and 50s, the man who had made the most hits, scored the most runs, and compiled the highest batting average in history, took a ragamuffin team that had finished last in 1968 and led them to first place with a miraculous combination of managerial insight and inspiration. Tom Seaver, Brooklyn's only bona fide star, had pitched on that day in 1969 and beat Bob Gibson 2-0. The Dodgers' runs had come, she remembered, on solo home runs by the elderly third baseman Ed the Glider Charles. That game had clinched the division flag for the Dodgers, and they went on to beat Milwaukee in the National League's first divisional playoffs, and then demolish the vaunted Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. Memories of the exultation of that day, when an entire city had roared a collective shout of glee, brought a smile to her face. It had been a rare moment, and looking back, she wished she'd been old enough to appreciate the absolute and pure joy, untainted by any other emotion or thought. She'd rarely experienced that feeling since, and never with tens of thousands of other people. The loud crack of a bat meeting a ball brought her back to the present, and she wiped the smile off her face. These reminiscences weren't doing any good. Fleeing the perilous present by taking refuge in pleasant memories of the past was no way, she realized, to solve anything. Men were after her, and she had to figure out why. Well, actually, she knew why. Obviously, they wanted the books back. But how had they tracked her down so quickly? And why did they kill Gruber? No, that's not right. They thought she had killed Gruber. She hadn't. If they hadn't, and she knew that she hadn't, who had? Something strange was going on, and Jennifer was caught in the middle of it. She suppressed a shiver. Suddenly, the sunlight wasn't as warm. The people around her didn't seem as innocent. Kian's men had tracked her to the Happy Hawker. They could very well track her here. Any one of these Dodger fans sitting around her could be a killer. She glanced around and froze when her worst fear seemed to be confirmed. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the dark-haired man who had been watching her in the ticket line. He was sitting two rows behind her and to her right. He was pretending to be looking at his scorecard, but he was also surreptitiously studying her. He could be the killer. At the very least, he must be an agent of Kian's. Jennifer looked firmly ahead. What to do? She could, of course, go to the police. But then she'd have to admit that she was Wraith, the daring thief who'd made the front page of even the staid New York Times. They could probably protect her from Kian's men, but she'd end up doing hard time for the string of burglaries she'd committed. She clenched her teeth as she saw from the corner of her eye that the man was moving toward her. What to do? What to do? The frantic refrain ran through her mind, keeping pace with the pounding of her racing heart. Nothing, she told herself. Be calm. Do nothing. Deny everything. He can't do anything to me with all these people around. Daryl Strawberry, the young right fielder obtained 2 years ago in a trade with the lowly Cubs, was putting on a show in the batting cage. Everyone's eyes were on him as he whacked balls into and over the bleachers in right, left, and center field. No one was looking at her and the man. Fear knotted her insides as he set a large hand lightly on her shoulder and said, in an unexpectedly soft voice, "Wraith." And she utterly and totally panicked at his use of her alias and ghosted, leaving him with an astonished look on his face as he stared at her pants and shoes lying in a crumpled heap before her bleacher seat, and holding her shirt in his right hand. She heard him blurt, "Wait!" And then she was gone, sinking through the structure of the bleachers like a stone ghost.
An officious security officer waved the limo to a position behind the bunting-hung stands. Riggs opened the door, and his expression gave new meaning to cat and canary. Tachyon, his color already heightened by her ministrations and the heat of the day, turned an even more fiery red and said in an urgent undertone, "We'll be leaving as soon as my speech is over." "Very good, Doctor. Will we then be going to Ebbets Field as planned?" "No." Tachyon added something explosive in his own language, and tucking Roulette's arm beneath his, escorted her up the back stairs and onto the stands. A large group of dignitaries were already assembled in a semicircle around the podium. She saw Hartman looking peevish while the mayor of New York hung over the back of his chair, and agitated for support for his upcoming gubernatorial race. The ace in the white jumpsuit, hood now thrown back, hovered solicitously nearby. He was staring glassily into the crowd at a nubile teenager whose breast strained at her halter top, and Roulette noticed that his face didn't quite come together. The eyes weren't quite level, and the nose seemed to blossom like a twisted tuber above a too small mouth and chin. He looked like an artist's clay model the artist had gotten bored with before completing the bust. Seated in the second row of chairs was a distinguished-looking Oriental. Periodically, he jotted quick notes in a leather-bound book, and Roulette noticed that the gold fountain pen left a trail of gold ink. She made a face over the affectation, considering how often money did not translate into class or taste. The man's dark eyes lifted from the book and stared with frightened intensity at a silver-haired man whose tailoring screamed, "Lawyer." This man seemed to be looking for an opening to interrupt the unending flow from Koch and speak to Hartman. At the far end of the front row sat a major rock and roll figure whose Joker Aid concerts had raised several $1 million, none of which had yet reached Joker Town. Roulette gave a cynical smile. From her days at the UN, she knew in just how many ways money could be channeled and skimmed. Tachyon and his clinic would be lucky if they ever saw $10,000. Her thoughts drew up short. The Takesian's voice penetrated her black study. "Roulette, here." She glanced about confused, focused on the folding metal chair, seated herself. "My God, Mrs. Brown Roxbury, what are you doing here?" She stared into Senator Hartman's pale brown eyes. He gave an embarrassed cough. "Oh, damn, that sounded rather rude, didn't it? I'm just so surprised and delighted to see you. Mr. Love told me you had left the UN, and I was sorry to hear it." "The UN? What is this talk of the UN? You worked there?" broke in Tachyon. "Senator, good to see you." The men shook hands across her. Roulette opened her mouth and shut it again as Hartman took over the conversation for her. "Yes, Mrs. Brown Roxbury was an economist with the United Nations Development Program." "Not that we ever managed to develop a damn thing," she replied mechanically. Hartman laughed. "That's my Roulette. You always did give him hell up there." "Mrs.? Don't panic, I'm divorced." Hartman went nattering on about the wonderful work being done by the IMF and the World Bank, while overhead the striped awning erected to give some relief from the sun snapped and popped in the wind. It created an odd punctuation to his sentences. "Yes, the electrification project in Zaire is a classic example of the fine work." A discreet cough interrupted the flow. "Senator?" "Yes, what is it?" "St. John Latham with Latham Strauss." Latham leaned in close, his pale eyes expressionless. "My client." A hand indicated the Oriental gentleman, and Hartman slewed around to look. "General Kien, how the hell are you? I didn't see you come sneaking up here. You should have said something." Kien slid the notebook into his coat pocket, rose and shook the senator's outstretched hand. "I didn't wish to disturb you." "Nonsense. I always have time for one of my staunchest supporters." Latham's pale, expressionless eyes shifted to Kien, back to the senator. "That being the case, Senator, the general has suffered a severe loss this morning. Several very valuable books of stamps were stolen from his safe, and the police are having little success in recovering them." The lawyer eyed Tachyon, but the alien showed no inclination to move. With a shrug, he continued, "In fact, they don't seem to give a damn. I pressed them and was told that given the other problems attendant on Wildcard Day, they haven't got time to worry about a simple burglary." "Outrageous. I'm afraid I don't have a lot of pull with New York's finest, nor would I want to tread on Mayor Koch's territory." A quick smile to the mayor, still hovering hopefully on the outskirts of the conversation. Hartman's eye slid thoughtfully across the ace. "Still, allow me to offer you, Mr. Ray, my faithful Justice Department watchdog." Kian tensed and exchanged a glance with his expressionless attorney. Roulette wondered if the lawyer's face ever displayed anything other than cold calculation. That would be fine. Sir, Ray interrupted, my job is to guard you, and meaning no offense, you're a hell of a lot more important than some stamps. Thank you for your concern, Billy, but your job is whatever the hell I tell you it is, and I'm telling you to help Mr. Latham. The senator didn't seem so charming now. The ace shrugged and capitulated. Thank you, Senator, Kian murmured softly, and he and Latham faded back through the chairs, drawing Billy Ray with them. Now, where were we? The smile was pinned firmly back into place. Oh, I remember, talking about your tremendous contributions. Roulette pressed her shoulder urgently against Tachyon's, with a display of that disconcerting sensitivity he understood. Ah, Senator, I see someone with whom I must speak. Adieu for the moment. Madame, will you walk? He rose, offered his arm to Roulette, and they moved quickly to the other side of the stand. A tide of humanity lapped at the edge of the stand and stretched away in a great undulating wave, filling the square before Jet Boy's tomb. Behind them loomed the tomb itself, huge flanged wings reaching to heaven. Through the tall, narrow window, she could see the full-size replica of the JB-1 suspended from the ceiling. And out front, the 20-foot-tall Jet Boy stared aloofly over the heads of the crowd. Curious little drama we witnessed, remarked Tachyon. Yes. He leaned back, looking up at her. And you don't like the senator. Why? Because I suspect he has an interest in the companies backing that multi-million-dollar boondoggle he was discussing with such relish. It sounded like it would help the people in Zaire. Hardly. It's been designed so no power can be siphoned off to provide services to the people living along its 1,100-mile line. It's basically a billion-dollar project to give money to that thug Mobutu and to line the pockets of various large international corporations and to make vast amounts of money in the form of interest for a number of large Western banks. It does fuck all for the people of Zaire, who will continue to live at a subsistence level despite one of the greatest repositories of mineral wealth on the continent. Roulette, you're wonderful. She spun to face him. If you're about to tell me how beautiful I am when I'm in a passion, I'll slug you off this stand. He held up his hands. No, no, I do admire the passion, and you are very beautiful. But you care. You're so interested. You remind me of another woman. The rather tangled sentence trailed away, and he seemed to be looking at some picture that had nothing to do with the holiday crowds that stretched away before them. Roulette, staring idly out, suddenly gasped as the shadow of a pterodactyl rippled over the people. She glanced up, and sure enough, a pterodactyl was winging its way toward them. Tachyon, alerted by her indrawn breath, sighed and made shooing motions with his hands. The prehistoric creature came on. The alien grabbed her about the waist and pulled her back beneath the awning just as several small pterodactyl turds pattered onto the stand. Kid! Tachyon shouted. Next time I catch you, I'm going to beat you! Koch was beckoning, so they returned to their chairs. 10 minutes later, a cute-faced kid with several inexpertly covered pimples on his chin and dressed in jeans and a t-shirt wiggled through the front row of the crowd and waved impudently up at the Takesian. Hey, Tacky, here I am. Well, at least you're dressed. I thought ahead. Left my clothes in the plane. A hand shot out indicating the tomb. Thought you were going to beat me. I may yet. Bet you can't. Koch was tapping the mic with a forefinger, sending booming, thrumming pops echoing across the square. Roulette, glancing between boy and alien, saw the human's eyes widen in alarm. Tachyon, with a guilty glance to Koch, darted to the edge of the stand. The kid turned, bent, and obligingly presented his posterior to the doctor, who gave him a quick but gentle kick in the seat. Kid, stay out of trouble. No fair. Disgusting alien powers used to abuse little kid, he said in a tone indicative of a headline from the National Informer. Juvenile delinquent uses ace powers to aggravate city. Aggravate? Can't I at least terrorize? Maybe when you're older. Koch was glaring at the pair. Now, shoo, I have to be dignified now. Good luck. And with a flip of the hand, he vanished back into the crowd. Who is he? Kid Dinosaur. He's very bright, but unfortunately at that awkward age between boy and man, which means he's something of a monster, he drives the aces mad, for he's always underfoot. It must be very trying to his parents to be raising an ace, but children are such a delight. Hey, you're on, Roulette said, interrupting the babble. Oh, by the idea, thank you. Leaning in close, he said with a wink, and then we can leave. She thought he presented a rather comic figure. Tiny little man, head just topping the podium, red satin suit, and long red hair like a punk Lord Fauntleroy. She noticed that he had no notes, and wondered if an extemporaneous speech was quite wise. Then he lifted his head and began, and comedy was replaced by dignity and a wealth of caring. I always find it a little difficult to think what to say on this day. Are we celebrating? And if so, what? Or are we honoring and remembering? And if so, who do we honor? And what do we remember as a guard against future mistakes? You'll hear a great deal today about Jet Boy, and the Turtle, and Cyclone, and 100 other aces. He waved at the great green shell where it hovered over the crowd. And yes, even about me. But I don't think that's fair, and I'm going to talk about other people. About Shiner, who gave a home to an abandoned child. And Jubal, who can always spare a dime for some other joker down on his luck. And Dez, who's done more to get parks built and schools improved in Jokertown than any other person. I speak about the jokers because I think they can offer a lesson and an example to other people. Their sufferings, mental, physical, and emotional, match anything experienced in human history. And they've tried a number of methods to cope with their isolation, ranging from quiet fortitude as they were abused by police and other public officials, to violence culminating in the events of 1976, and now a new approach. A sense of self-reliance and sharing that has allowed them to build, within the confines of our so-called Joker Town, a true community. I point out the various accomplishments of these remarkable people, because there is a new mood in this country which I find fearsome. There is once again an attempt to delineate what is American, to despise and discriminate against those who exist on the periphery of this fairy tale majority. And it is a fairy tale. Each person is an utterly unique individual. There is no consensus of opinion, no right way to do things. There are only people who, no matter how hideous and twisted on the outside, are internally driven by the same hopes and dreams and aspirations that drive all of us. I suppose what I really want to say on this wild card day, 1986, is be kind. For adversity comes from many sources, not just from alien virus,
brought across light years, and there may come a time when all of us, Nats, Aces, and Jokers alike, will need that kind word, that offer of help, that sense of community that the Joker so wonderfully represent. Thank you. The applause was thunderous, but Tachyon looked unhappy as he walked back to her. Very noble. But how do you think it will play? Roulette asked as he scooped his hat off the chair. Her arm was once more pulled through his, and he urged her toward the back stairs. Some people will compare me to Mother Teresa, and others will say I am a self-serving son of a bitch. And you? What do you say? That I am neither. Just a man, trying to live with honor, and to embrace whatever happiness is given me. They were standing by the limo, and Tachyon suddenly wrapped his arms about her waist and buried his face in her bosom. And I'm glad you are here to be embraced. Furiously, she cast him off and backed away until brought up short by the back of the car. Don't look to me for comfort. I have none for anybody. I told you that already. And what do you need it for anyway? You're the saint of Jokertown, the big shot with the private limo, as much a star as any of the aces. Yes, yes, and yes, but I am also consumed with guilt, devoured by a failure that gathers every year on September 15th to haunt me. God, how I hate this day. His fist slammed onto the top of the car, and Riggs drifted away to stare in fascination at the cuff of his uniform coat. Tachyon's shoulders shook for several seconds. Then he dashed a hand across his eyes and turned back to face her. All right. You have no comfort for me. I accept that. You said you were on a pilgrimage of despair. So am I. So let us at least journey together. And if we can't comfort, we can at least share. Fine. She climbed into the car and rested her head against the window. And maybe I can do something. I can free you from your guilt, and by destroying you, perhaps find my own peace.
Jennifer pulled herself through an endless expanse of concrete and steel, looking for a place where she could solidify and take a much-needed breather. She felt lightheaded, even for a specter, and it was getting hard to concentrate. She had an overwhelming urge to simply drift, to float disembodied like a cloud and forget all her worries, all the danger that was dogging her footsteps like a snarling Doberman. But she couldn't give in to that urge. If she did, she'd lose all being and become an attenuated will of the wisp, floating mindlessly until the random forces of Brownian movement scattered her to all corners of the earth. It was hard to work up the urgency to make herself move faster, but Jennifer succeeded, pulling herself through the last of the bleacher supports. She found herself in a carpeted corridor lit by overhead fluorescent lamps and immediately solidified and leaned shakily against the corridor wall. She still felt distant and disoriented, and her head swam with vertigo. It had been close, but she'd solidified in time. She realized that she had to be careful about using her powers for a time, until she was certain that her system hadn't been overtaxed. Now, Jennifer thought, if she could only orient herself, she'd get the hell out. The only problem was she'd never been in the bowels of Ebbets Field before, and she had no idea where she was. There was a double door at one end of the corridor. In the opposite direction, the corridor branched. She had to go one way or the other, and Jennifer chose the doors. Unfortunately, they were blank, with no windows set in them. Well, she thought, if anyone questioned her, she'd simply say she'd gotten lost, although why she was wearing only a bikini might be hard to explain. She took a deep breath, let it out noisily, and pushed the doors open. She took a step into a large, well-lit, richly carpeted room, and froze. The murmur of a dozen conversations gradually died down as all eyes in the room turned toward her. I don't believe it, she told herself. She closed her eyes, but when she opened them, a moment later, everyone was still there, staring. I don't believe I just walked into the Dodgers' locker room. 20 men were in the room. Some were playing cards in small groups, some were talking. Hernandez, the first baseman, was sitting by his locker doing his customary pre-game crossword puzzle. Pete Reeser himself, 60-ish, gray-haired but still lean and arrow-straight, was standing in front of Seaver's locker, talking with the pitcher and the Dodgers' Cuban pitching coach, Fidel Castro. Some of the players still had their practice jerseys on. Some had started to change their game uniforms. Some hadn't gotten very far in the change. Jennifer, feeling the pressure of all those eyes on her, felt she should say something. But when she opened her mouth, no words would come. She tried again. Good luck today. A small metallic snuffbox slipped out of the hand of Thurman Munson, veteran Dodger catcher and team captain, and the sudden sound it made as it clattered against the stool in front of his locker broke the spell that seemed to hold everyone. A dozen players spoke at once, from Reeser's strident, "How the hell did you get in here?" to half a dozen variations on, "Geez, nice body," and "Great outfit." Jennifer, mortified, forgot her earlier worries and ghosted through the nearest wall into a small room with a drug cabinet, a couple of empty padded tables, a bunch of incomprehensible machines, and a dripping Dwight Gooden climbing naked out of the whirlpool. "Hey," he said as she went by. "Great game yesterday," Jennifer said, smiling weakly. He slid back into the whirlpool, ducking down so the water came up to his chin, and stared in disbelief as she passed through the wall next to the whirlpool. Great body, too, Jennifer told herself, sneaking a final peek before she vanished.
As a capo working for Rosemary's father, Don Carlo Gambione, Don Federico the Butcher Macellaio had once ordered Bagabond's death. Bagabond had not forgotten. Standing beside an oak in a nearly deserted Central Park, she started toward Central Park West and was glad most of New York appeared to be down at Jet Boy's tomb. She felt conspicuous in the brown tweed business suit and high heels she'd scavenged from one of her subterranean stashes. But this way, none of the normal denizens of the park could possibly recognize her. A few of the street people had seen too much over the years. It was best to be discreet. She slid her aching left foot out of the shoe and stood, weight on her right leg, as she watched Don Federico exit his exclusive apartment building. The sheltering canopy said, "The Luxor." Dressed in an expensively tailored black suit, the butcher crossed the sidewalk to a white Cadillac stretch limousine. He was flanked by two guards in dark glasses and unbuttoned suit jackets. Getting into the car, Don Federico snatched the door out of his chauffeur's hand and slammed it. The driver paused for a fraction of a second before turning sharply around and getting into the car. One of the guards got into the front seat beside the driver, while the other appeared to scan the sidewalk and Central Park West in both directions. The limousine pulled out and crossed against horn-blowing traffic to enter the park at the West Drive. With disbelief, Rosemary had once told her about the Don's habits. It was always the same route. The Don was either very stupid or very self-assured. A show of power. Knowing the limo would drive across the transverse, then exit onto 65th, and cruise past Temple Emmanuel to the butcher's favorite restaurant, Aronica's, Bagabond walked at an oblique angle through the park. She mentally summoned a flock of pigeons and nearly 100 squirrels. They waited at the stone bridge near the middle of the drive. As Bagabond walked across the park to meet them, a large gray cat, one of the Blacks and Calico's offspring, dropped out of a lightning-warped maple tree to block her path. The gray was one of the few kittens at least as intelligent as his parents. He had refused to join Bagabond's group of animals when he understood how Bagabond used the creatures to her advantage, sometimes without caring about the effect on the animals' lives. The gray had chosen to live apart, in a section of Central Park Bagabond used only infrequently. He resented her presence. Now Bagabond told him she would not be there long. The cat imaged dead bodies scattered across the landscape. Bagabond stiffened and told him to leave her. He turned and trotted a few yards away before he turned and spat at her. She reached out with her mind to attack, but stopped before she burned out his brain. The gray disappeared into a stand of maples. Clenching her fists, Vagabond stood, watching the cat. Then she was abruptly aware of the progress of the Dawn's car. A peregrine, escaped from a would-be urban falconer, was Vagabond's eye, following the butcher's car as it cruised through the park. There were no colors, but the perception of movement caught her consciousness as the falcon's eyes roamed across the park. She brought him gliding back around to follow the butcher's car. According to Rosemary's file, Don Federico Macellaio used this daily drive to order the deaths of his opponents from his armored, surveillance-proof car. Vagabond leaned back against a broad tree trunk, kicked off her shoes, and concentrated on directing her animals. As she began the mental routine of organizing and directing the birds and animals she had summoned, Vagabond realized that the gray was hiding among the maples and observing her. She warned him off, but he responded with an image of himself marking the trees to show his territory. She ignored him as the Dawn's car drew closer to the spot she had chosen. She found she was nervous at the car's approach. The gray had broken her concentration. He had a gift for making her think in ways she normally avoided. The butcher was Rosemary's enemy, as well as her own. She had learned from the animals themselves to kill or be killed. The butcher was a threat that had to be removed. Besides, it would please Rosemary. It was obvious to Vagabond that Rosemary was too worried about too many things. Her concern with the Gambiones had become consuming. With a new Dawn, she could relax and spend more time with Vagabond. Vagabond wanted that enough to disturb the rhythms and lives of her creatures. To kill them. She closed the gray out of her mind and sent pain down the connection joining them. The gray yowled as she felt the energy hit him. The part of her mind that was organizing the birds had completed that task. The flocks of pigeons temporarily roosted in the trees around the bridge. For an instant, there was an unnatural stillness. Breaking out of the trees, gleaming as the sun hit the finish, the limousine proceeded around the corner on its stately way. The mirrored windshield reflected the tree branches overhead. A lone pigeon wheeled free of the flock and, at Vagabond's command, sent itself soaring high into the sky. Then it hurled itself down at the limousine's windshield, as though intending to land on one of the phantom trees. Blood splattered the white paint of the hood. The driver braked and seemed to hesitate for an instant before continuing. Vagabond watched the scene in fragments, seen through the eyes of the hawk now behind the car, and the pigeons above and before the limousine. Her own eyes were wide and staring, but the other visions overwhelmed her human sight. She damped the pain of the pigeon in the same way she removed from her consciousness the constant deaths she normally experienced. Overhead, 100 birds stopped cooing as she took them over completely. The avian wave swept down toward the car, covering it in a cloak of blood and feathers. The limousine's brakes shrieked as the driver attempted a panic stop before his blindness wrecked the car. Keeping more of the pigeons in reserve, Vagabond shifted her attention to the hordes of squirrels gathered in the lower branches of the oaks and maples lining the road. As she directed a battalion of squirrels toward the swerving car, pain careened across her own mind. Her first thought was that either the black or the calico was in trouble. But tracing their individual patterns within her awareness of the city's wild ones told her that the cats were well. The gray. He deliberately was inflicting pain on himself, trying to destroy her concentration. Vagabond reprimanded him mentally, sending waves of emotional chill stunning his rebellion. Only a few seconds had passed, but the driver was close to regaining control when the roadway became a moving carpet of squirrels. The driver had accelerated to escape the birds. Vagabond sent the animals under the wheels of the car. The shrieks of the dying squirrels mixed with the sound of abused brakes. The heavy car's momentum carried it across the massed rodents. Their blood greased the road and the limousine skidded sideways. Now the doors and side panels were streaked and spattered with blood. Vagabond's head snapped to the side as feedback from the gray flooded her mind. This time he was not satisfied with distraction. Now he tried to disperse the animals, using Vagabond as a focus. Her anger streamed out, knocking him unconscious. She might have killed him, but her attention was needed at the bridge. The driver had overcorrected for the skid and sent the car into a spin. The right wheel struck the low guardrail, bending it out. The mass of the car's armor plate sent it crashing through the retaining wall and over the side. Streaks of white paint remained on the metal and concrete. One wheel cover was slung free. It preceded the limousine over the edge, skimming slowly through the air like a frisbee. The automobile wasn't so fortunate. Time for Vagabond seemed to stop as she watched the car roll over in the air. One part of her was ending the lives of the birds and squirrels injured in the attack. Another part considered the murder and wondered if it was worth the cost to help a friend and take revenge. The vehicle plunged to the jogging path. It landed hard on the concrete trail, crushing the roof of the passenger compartment flush with the body. The car rocked to a halt and burst into a whuffing ball of flame. Sacrificing a few animals to feed others had been nothing compared to this carnage, she saw as she looked around at the bridge. Bodies were scattered everywhere. She felt a pain she had not experienced since first learning to distance the lives of her animals from her own. Maybe the gray had been right to attempt to stop her. The side of her mind she considered human was happy for her success, eager to find out Rosemary's reaction. The animal side wanted to reject what she had done. Abruptly, Vagabond realized that the remaining creatures waited patiently for her instructions. The dark cloud of pigeons rose into the sky and dispersed in all directions. No one saw the undulating mass of squirrels break apart and run for the wooded sections of the park. Vagabond was already hidden by the trees and walking toward the subway entrance at Columbus Circle. Before she could cross 59th Street, the recovered gray confronted her with the image of what she had done, an image that changed into a picture of her lying bloody and broken on the ground. Vagabond paused, staggered by the final realization of what she had done. This was not an occasional sacrifice for food or her own protection. She had used the animals she had always protected in her own war to achieve a goal that had meaning only to her. She had betrayed a trust she had held since she came back from the hospital. Vagabond felt sick. It was not the Gray's doing. She hoped Rosemary was worth it. Rosemary waited, if unknowingly. Before checking in with her, Vagabond would go by Jack's home to check for messages about his missing niece, Cordelia. Maybe now there would be time to help him. Vagabond walked down the steps into the subway station and used one of the tokens the raccoon had proved so adept at stealing. Taking the number one local downtown, she ignored the admiring glances she attracted from her male fellow passengers.
Chapter 8 1 p.m. The street was still crowded with late-arriving fans, souvenir sellers, and ticket scalpers. Somehow, Jennifer managed to slip through the outer wall of the stadium without anyone noticing, but on the street, she attracted a fair amount of attention. Heads turned and wolf whistles followed her down the street, but she barely noticed. She moved quickly, watching out for the men who had tried to grab her in the Happy Hawker and the man who had followed her into the stadium, but none of them seemed to be around. She spotted an empty taxi, flagged it down, and told the driver, "Manhattan." She settled down to think as the taxi carried her back to more familiar territory. Events around her were moving with incomprehensible speed and violence. Kien must really want his stamps back, she thought. Unless it was the other book. She glanced at her purse, a small leather bag closed by a simple drawstring. It had the stolen books and a few dollars she carried for emergencies like this, but nothing else. No wallet, no identification. The whole thing was going sour. Feeling eyes upon her, she looked up into the mirror and caught the cab driver staring at her. He looked away, and Jennifer tried to sink further back into the stained and worn upholstery of the cab's back seat. She had to find some decent clothes somewhere. As it was, she looked as if she were dressed for a Rio de Janeiro carnival. Maybe, she thought, she'd better call it off and return the books. They'd already cost Gruber his life, though for the life of her she couldn't figure out who had killed him and given her a few too many close brushes with violence. She'd have to contact Kien. That'd be easy, but the details of the exchange might be tricky to work out. Also, she didn't want to come out of this thing entirely empty-handed. She looked out the window of the cab pensively, and struck by sudden inspiration, called out, "Stop! Stop right here!" The driver took her at her word and slammed on the brakes, bringing the taxi to a screeching halt. She could hear tires squeal behind them as she leaped out and tossed some crumpled bills onto the front seat. "Thanks," she said breathlessly, and turned and ran up the street. "My pleasure," the cabbie said with a bemused expression, watching her bikini-clad form with appreciation as she ran up to the front of the famous Bowery Wildcard Dime Museum.
"Jack? Jack? It is you, am I not right?"
A familiar voice, any familiar voice in the village's circus atmosphere today was a shock. Jack turned and saw a handsome man, half a head taller than he, looking down at him.
"Hello, Jean-Jacques,"
Jack said. Jean-Jacques had arrived from Senegal 6 years ago. He worked part of the time as a waiter at the Simba on 6th Avenue at 8th, and the rest of the time as a tutor for foreign students learning English at the new school. Jack had never seen a man with more striking features.
"Listen," he said to the other, "I need some help."
He took out Cordelia's snapshot. Jean-Jacques nodded but seemed distracted.
"Anything, my friend. Anything at all."
Jack knew there was something wrong.
"What is it?"
"Nothing to be of concern."
Jean-Jacques looked away toward the pedestrians moving briskly past them. The early afternoon sun shone on his skin so that the deep black shone almost blue.
"I doubt that."
Jack put a hand on the man's shoulder, conscious of the warm vitality radiating through the bright pattern.
"Tell me."
Jean-Jacques looked back at Jack, his penetrating gaze meeting Jack's eyes.
"It is the retrovirus,"
he said.
"It is the killer. I have just been to see my doctor. The diagnosis was unfortunately positive."
He sighed.
"Quite positive." "Retrovirus," said Jack. "You mean the wild card?"
"No,"
Jean-Jacques interrupted him.
"The Shura killer."
The words seemed to stick in his throat.
"It's Mother of Jesus,"
said Jack.
"I am sorry."
He started closer to Jean-Jacques, caught himself for just a second, then went ahead and embraced the man.
"I'm very sorry."
Jean-Jacques gently pushed Jack away.
"I understand,"
he said simply.
"You are not the first I have told. Already they are treating me like one of the damnable jokers."
He shut his eyes sadly, then opened them and said,
"Don't worry, old friend. You are all right. I know who it was."
He shut his eyes again.
"And I know when it was."
His head began to shake slightly, and Jack again embraced him. This time Jean-Jacques did not push him immediately away.
"I think you are on a mission,"
Jean-Jacques said.
"Tell me what you are seeking, and if I can help, I shall."
Jack hesitated, then told him about Cordelia. The Senegalese inspected the photograph.
"A very beautiful young lady."
He glanced at Jack.
"You share the same eyes."
Then he handed back the picture.
"Go,"
he said.
"Continue your search. As I said, if I observe anything that could be of use to you, I will let you know."
There was nothing more to say, but Jack remained there beside Jean-Jacques.
"Go,"
Jean-Jacques repeated. He smiled slightly.
"Good fortune."
Then he turned on his heel and was gone.
"This is your important stop?" Roulette asked, eyeing the decaying wall of a riverfront warehouse. Takian had dismissed Riggs several blocks away, and a brisk, sweat-raising walk had ended here. He glanced back over his shoulder as his slender hands opened the large, shiny padlock. His expression was one of suppressed excitement and mischief, rather like a little boy about to show off his collection of tadpoles. And she suddenly realized that he was very young. Because of mutation and their obsession with the life sciences,
The Takesian lifespan was vastly longer than the human. Tachyon at 80-something was a graybeard by Earth standards, but only verging on manhood by Takesian norms. It explained a lot. The door swung open on well-oiled hinges, and he waved her through. Her sharp retreat brought her up hard against his chest. "Don't be afraid." "My God, what?" She glanced cautiously at the glowing monstrosity squatting in the center of the empty, echoing room. It looked rather like a wintle-trapped seashell, but the tips of its gray spines were set with glowing amber and purple lights. It also seemed to be resting in a glittering whirlpool, for dust was spiraling in toward the creature. "The ship." "What?" "Your ship," she amended quickly. "Yes, baby." "Baby?" "Uh-huh." Tachyon's lilac eyes rested lovingly on the ship. In Roulette's shields, painstakingly erected by the astronomer, responded to a nearby telepathic communication. "She's frustrated. She tried to say hello to you, but you have shields." He cocked his head to one side, seriously regarding her. "Strange. Most humans..." A quick shake of the head. "Well, come inside."
I'd rather not."
"She won't hurt you."
"Oh, it's not that."
"What then?" She hunched her shoulders and walked toward the ship, though it felt like a betrayal. Sometime early tomorrow morning, the astronomer would seize this living vessel and pilot her far away. The ship obligingly opened her lock, and they entered the control room. The inner walls and floor of the ship glowed like polished mother of pearl, casting opalescent light across the large canopy bed that dominated the room. Tachyon chuckled.
"Your expression is priceless."
"You see, unlike most of my kind, I vowed I would die in bed. This seemed to be a way to ensure it." The rest of the furniture had a fragile beauty, and it was clear from the width of the chair seats that Takesians were smaller than humans, unless this furniture had been made for Tachyon's personal use. The alien took her gently by the shoulders and indicated the wall. Flowing silver script gleamed.
"Greetings, Roulette."
R-O-O-L-E-T-E. Tachyon smiled and shook his head. "Roulette. R-O-U-L-E-T-T-E. Her spelling isn't so good yet. She just started this when I had some other friends aboard. She's picking up a knowledge of written English by a low-level drain. I'm indulgent, so I let her get away with it."
"It's unbelievable."
She seated herself on the bed while Tachyon unearthed a pair of crystal goblets from a chest, which seemed to be an extrusion of the ship herself. Another message flitted across the wall while the alien's back was turned. "You are honored." There was something peevish about the message.
"Cut it out, baby," warned Tachyon.
"Apology." "Accepted," Roulette said, feeling like an idiot. Tachyon splashed a dollop of brandy into each glass from his hip flask. Two bright spots of color were burning on his cheeks. "You are the first woman I've ever brought here. So she is curious, hopeful, and a little resentful."
"She loves you."
"Yes, and I her." He brushed his palm across one curving wall.
"Why hopeful?"
She took a sip of cognac. "Despite being a little jealous, she wants to see me marry and sire children. Pedigree, continuance, is very important to the ships. Over the centuries, they've absorbed our obsession with ancestor worship, and she considers me a failure. I keep telling her I have a lot of time left, especially since I now live on Earth." He joined her on the bed.
I've read a great deal about you, but I've never seen this mentioned. Of course, it's logical you would have a ship. How else would you have gotten here?
I try to keep it very quiet. When I was trying to recover her from the government, I raised a great to-do about Baby. Now I'm more cautious, and fortunately people's memories are short. Unfortunately, she gets lonely, so I come as often as I can. She misses her own kind, too. They are essentially herd creatures, and this kind of isolation is not good for her.
Why don't you live in her, then?
I want a social life, and I also want to keep her secret. Those two goals rather conflict, so I compromise. I live nearby. I visit often, and sometimes I take her out. According to Sister Magdalene at the South Street Mission, I am doing a positive service. She's had several derelicts take the pledge after spotting us. She laughed, leaned down and kissed him where he reclined against the cushions. He caught the top button of her blouse in trembling fingers, and from the corner of her eye she could see his erection straining at the satin material of his breeches. She jerked away and swiftly rebuttoned her blouse. I'm sorry, but I thought you... We...
Not here. I couldn't perform with an audience. She also wondered what would be the ship's reaction if she killed Tachyon within Baby's skin. Roulette doubted she'd leave the ship alive.
The famous Bowery Wild Card Dime Museum, admission only $2, was closed, probably because its manager realized that most people would be taking advantage of the day's free entertainment. That was, Jennifer thought, just fine. She went down a side alley and, making sure no one was watching, slipped through the wall. It was difficult. It took some moments of concentration, and then she had to fight her way through the brickwork as if she were solid and the bricks were a viscous, unyielding liquid. Her body was getting tired, and she knew that she shouldn't ghost for a while, but she had to get this done, and then maybe she could think about resting. She finally made it through and found herself in a small dark room with a series of dimly glowing glass bottles set along one wall like a bank of aquariums in a pet store. Floating in the tanks were pathetic little corpses, little embalmed monstrous joker babies, as the sign above the exhibit proclaimed. There were maybe 30 of them. Most had little of humanity about them, and Jennifer was thankful, in a way, that they had experienced for so short a time the cruelty of the world. She hurried from the room and found herself in the section of the museum devoted to large displays that were life-size dioramas. It was eerily quiet and dark with the display's lighting and sound effects turned off, and quite disconcerting to be the only living thing about. She went by a scene depicting Jokertown burning, commemorating, as it were, the great Jokertown riot of 1976. There was, now only mildly shocking to modern tastes, an older tableau showing a purported Jokertown orgy. A sign in front of a curtained-off area said to watch for the latest addition to the entertaining yet informative displays, Earth versus the Swarm. Jennifer went on past the dioramas into the long hallway beyond and entered the museum's Hall of Fame, or, in some instances, infamy. Lifelike wax figures of prominent aces and jokers clustered in groups or stood alone in the hallway. Jet Boy looked young and handsome, his scarf blowing out behind him in an unfelt, perhaps divine wind, his eyes squinting slightly as if he were staring into a gentle sun. The four aces, Black Eagle, Brain Trust, the Envoy, and Golden Boy, stood in a group, three of them together, one isolated by the slightly turned backs, the slightly averted faces of his fellow aces. Dr. Tachyon was resplendent in an outfit that a small card at his feet said had been donated by him to the museum. And there were others. Peregrine, maintaining, Jennifer had to admit, her smoldering sensuality even when graven in wax. Cyclone, Hiram Worcester's astonishing bulk apparently floating lightly over his pedestal. chrysalis with invisible flesh and visible organs caged by her skeleton. Jennifer looked them over carefully. Tachyon, she decided, would be the one. She stepped over the velvet rope and approached the waxen statue. She towered over it by half a foot, and its waxen features were as delicate as her own. Moved by an irresistible impulse, she ran her hand down the rich fabric of his peach-colored waistcoat. It had a fine, soft feel to it. She could almost believe that the card was telling the truth, and the outfit had once belonged to Tachyon himself. She caught herself and looked around guiltily. The hallway, of course, was deserted. She summoned all her will, reached out, and put the bag through the chest of the wax figure. She withdrew her hand and left the bag snug in Tachyon's chest, the two stock books of stamps and the mysterious volume safely hidden away until her return. Now she had to get in touch with Kian. It might take some doing. She couldn't simply look him up in the phone book. She left the Hall of Fame with one last jealous glance at the peregrine figure, pondering her next move. She never noticed the eye watching from a curtained doorway at the other end of the hallway.